Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Today, February 1st, is the first day of Black History Month, America's belated homage to African Americans, without whom there would be no America, despite white America's reluctance to acknowledge that truth. And this year especially, with the xenophobic surge of Donald Trump, it is more than ever necessary to counteract the retrogressive racism emanating from the White House, which is why recognition of Black History Month is more urgently relevant than since its overdue official ratification in 1976, two centuries after the incubation of the United States and a century after the Civil War. The essential idea for Black History Month came from a Black American historian and educator named Carter Goodwin Woodson, who in 1915 co-founded the Association for the Study of Negro Life and History with a prominent Black minister, Jesse E. Moreland, which is now known as the Association of African American Life and History. Woodson said of the need for such an acknowledgement of Black history, "If a race has no history, it has no worthwhile tradition in the thought of the world, and it stands in danger of being exterminated." Australian historian Jeff Sparrow says essentially the same in a recent biography of the late, great Paul Robeson, that Black people have been made to feel fundamentally alien in American society as well as in its history, that they are the other, and as a result, ghettoized, victims of, quote, unspeakable brutality and contempt, which has been the norm even following their liberation from slavery. Robeson himself said at a post-World War II peace conference in Paris, "We in America do not forget that it was on the backs of white workers from Europe and on the backs of millions of Blacks that the wealth of America was built, and we are resolved to share it equally." And he said much the same when he was subpoenaed to appear before the House Un-American Activities Committee. "Because my father was a slave and my people died to build this country, I am going to stay here and have a part of it, like you, and no fascist-minded people will drive me from it." Robeson was only 3 years old when President Theodore Roosevelt emulated Abraham Lincoln's Civil War invitation to talk with Stephen Douglas in the White House by inviting former slave and founder of Black colleges, Booker T. Washington, to the White House for lunch in 1901. The immediate reaction was framed by North Carolina Senator Benjamin Tillman, who ranted that 1,000 Southern Blacks would have to be killed before they learned their place again, quote unquote. A couple of graphic examples of that place Blacks occupy in the white consciousness were recorded by historian Sparrow when he interviewed a white Southern family who recalled that their slave-owning ancestors had whipped a young Black slave girl, quote, to the bone, for dropping and breaking a dish. And a highly educated Black actor who told him that talking with whites, he sometimes envisioned that they saw him with thick lips and a bone through his nose. Paul Robeson died in 1976, the same year Black History Month was proclaimed by President Gerald Ford, also a Republican, like Lincoln and Roosevelt I. Initially, Carter Woodson and the African American Association sponsored a Negro History Week in 1926, choosing the second week in February because it encompassed both Frederick Douglass's birthday on February 14th and Abraham Lincoln's birthday on February 12th. Despite the proliferation of Black history clubs and a newfound appreciation of Black culture and literature nationally, especially among middle-class whites and Blacks, the idea of expanding the week to a month did not occur until half a century later. And although freedom schools were established during the Civil Rights Movement in the 1960s, the most popular textbook for 8th grade U.S. history classes mentioned only two Black people in the entire century since the Civil War. By the early 1970s, however, colleges and universities and a few cities, mostly in the North and Pacific Coastal West, persisted in finally extending the week into a month, but not until 1976 was it officially recognized as a national observance by President Ford on both the 50th anniversary of its first commemoration in 1926 and America's bicentennial year. Ford said in tribute to Black History Month, "In celebrating Black History Month, we can seize the opportunity to honor the too often neglected accomplishments of Black Americans in every area of endeavor throughout our history. Now we have Trump as president, perhaps the most brazenly worthless in American history, to use his form of superlative. He took the lead of the birther movement against Barack Obama because he vociferously proclaimed that no Black person was worthy of being president and none qualified. As has been noted, Trump has virtually dedicated his presidency to undoing everything Obama accomplished, to, in fact, erase Obama from history. Perhaps Trump's ultimate aim is to either banish Blacks to some place like an earlier diaspora to Liberia, or rigorously pin them all up in ghettos as the Nazis did Jews before exterminating them. But for now, he seems to be using his outrage against Obama to put Blacks back in their supposed antebellum place." And that book about Paul Robeson by Jeff Sparrow is titled No Way But This, In Search of Paul Robeson. And now, an article by Deneen L. Brown for the Washington Post, "When Portland Banned Blacks, Oregon's Shameful History as an All-White State." In 1844, all Black people were ordered to get out of Oregon country, the expansive territory under American rule that stretched from the Pacific coast to the Rocky Mountains. Those who refused to leave could be severely whipped, the provisional government law declared, by not less than 20 or more than 39 strikes to be repeated every 6 months until they left. Oregon country's provisional government, which was led by Peter Burnett, a former slaveholder who came west from Missouri by a wagon train, passed the law in 1844, 15 years before Oregon became a state. The law allowed slaveholders to keep their slaves for a maximum of 3 years. After the grace period, all Black people, those considered freed or enslaved, were required to leave Oregon country. Black women were given 3 years to get out. Black men were required to leave in two. The law became known as the Peter Burnett Lash Law. Burnett, who also opposed Chinese migration to Oregon country, would later become the first American governor of California. The Lash Law was quickly amended and then repealed. No Black people were ever lashed under the law. But the act would become the first of three exclusion laws that shaped the Pacific Northwest, banning any additional Black people from coming to Oregon country. Those laws created what one African-American professor calls a very hostile environment that has long made Oregon and its largest city, Portland, a stronghold for white supremacists like Jerry Joseph Christian, the man accused of killing two men and severely wounding another on a light rail train in May 2017. Few people are aware of Oregon's history of blatant racism, including its refusal to ratify the 14th and 15th Amendments of the Constitution. In 1848, the territorial government passed a law making it illegal for any Negro or mulatto to live in Oregon country. In 1850, under the Oregon Donation Land Act, whites and half-breeds, and that's a quote, were granted 650 acres of land from the government, but any other person of color was excluded from claiming land in Oregon. In 1851, Jacob Vanderpool, the Black owner of a saloon, restaurant, and boarding home, was actually expelled from Oregon Territory. The exclusion laws were primarily intended to prevent Blacks from settling in Oregon, not to kick out those who were already here, according to Salem Public Library records. But Vanderpool's neighbor reported him for the crime of being Black in Oregon and Judge Thomas Nelson gave him 30 days to leave the territory. In 1857, as Oregon sought to become a state, it wrote the exclusion of blacks into its constitution. No free Negro or mulatto not residing in this state at the time of the adoption of this constitution shall ever come, reside, or be within this state, or hold any real estate, or make any contract, or maintain any suit therein, and the legislative assembly shall provide by penal laws for the removal by public officers of all such free Negroes and mulattoes, and for their effectual exclusion from the state, and for the punishment of persons who shall bring them into the state, or employ or harbor them therein. When Oregon entered the Union in 1859, it did so as a whites-only state. The original state constitution banned slavery, but also excluded non-whites from living there. Oregon is the only state in the United States that actually began as literally whites-only, said Winston Grady Willis, director of Portland State University's School of Gender, Race, and Nations. Even though there was subsequent legislation that challenged those statutes, the statutes were not removed from the books until 1922, Grady said. Grady Willis added, "It's really important for folks to understand this notion of Oregon as this lily white state sets the tone and is important structurally for the remainder of history of not only this state, but cities like Portland as well." Portland's reputation as a progressive city is largely a myth, he said. Portland remains the whitest large city in the United States. According to a July 2015 census report, the city of 612,206 people was 77.6% white and 5.8% black. Grady Willis called it a key state for KKK Ku Klux Klan activity. This is the historical backdrop for the charges against Christian, 35, who allegedly verbally abused two women on the train, which was Max, including one wearing hijab, and then attacked the men who came to their aid. During a brief court hearing in June last year, Christian was unapologetic. "You call it terrorism," Christian said in court. "I call it patriotism." Oregon has a defiant history of resisting federal laws that gave black people rights. Karen Gibson, associate professor in Portland State's Tulane School of Urban Studies and Planning, said Oregon rescinded its initial ratification of the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which granted citizenship to, quote, all persons born or naturalized in the United States, unquote, including former slaves. Oregon was one of just six states that refused to ratify the 15th Amendment, which gave black men the right to vote. Oregon did not ratify the 15th Amendment until 1959, 100 years after the state joined the Union. It was a symbolic adoption as part of its centennial celebration. It did not re-ratify the 14th Amendment until 1973. Many of the white settlers who came here for the Oregon Land Donation Act, this place was intentionally settled by whites for whites, Gibson said. They did not want slavery here. They didn't want land taken over by large plantations, so they didn't have to compete with bonded labor. But they also thought blacks were inferior. That is still here. White supremacy is about that, the belief that whites were supreme. And that was Gibson. Daryl Milner, professor emeritus in Portland State's Black Studies Department, said many early Oregon settlers were opposed to slavery, not because of what it did to blacks, but because of what it did to them, Milner said. Slavery represented a competition they did not wish to work against. Milner said Oregon became a place where many practices we associate with the Jim Crow South were legal here. In the 1920s, Oregon had the largest Ku Klux Klan organization west of the Mississippi River. In 1922, Walter Pierce, a member of the Ku Klux Klan, was elected governor of Oregon. Pierce served as a member of the U.S. House of Representatives from 1932 to 1942. Oregon's hostility toward blacks remains part of the state's culture. In the 1980s and 90s, Oregon became a destination for the largest skinhead movement in the country, Milner said. Their objective was to achieve something pioneers tried to achieve here, and that was to create a white homeland. Milner said that in the 1980s and 90s, in Oregon and especially in Portland, it was very dangerous to be a person of color. An infamous racial attack occurred in Portland in 1988 when an Ethiopian immigrant was fatally beaten by three white supremacist skinheads on the streets of Portland. Mulugeta Surau was a student at Portland State University. He was killed by three white supremacists who were members of the white Aryan resistance who beat him with a baseball bat. In 1990, the Southern Poverty Law Center and the Anti-Defamation League won a lawsuit against the white Aryan resistance on behalf of Surau's family. Milner said he has lived in Oregon 47 years. When he heard about the stabbings on the train last year, he said he was disturbed but not surprised. It reinforced the subterranean awareness of all people of color in Oregon have that something like that could happen to them at any time and in any place, he said. That is reflective of what people of color in Oregon live with. It is on a subconscious level daily. You are constantly aware that that is a possibility. And that was Milner. And this was a story by Deneen L. Brown, When Portland Banned Blacks, Oregon's Shameful History as an All-White State. And now, by Dr. Robert Brake, who lives in Ocean Park, Washington, Why We Must Protect the First Amendment. My questions are, does the First Amendment need a rewrite in the era of Donald Trump? And should the rise of white supremacist and neo-Nazi groups prompt us to cut back the protections afforded to speech that expresses hatred and advocates violence? After the tragic violence at a white supremacist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, on August 12, 2017, those questions take on renewed urgency. Those thorny issues require me to first indulge in some personal history. For 12 years, 1968 to 1980, I lived in Normal, Illinois, where, among other assignments, I taught COM 304, Freedom of Speech and Press, at Illinois State University. My course focused on Supreme Court decisions relating to political dissent, obscenity, provocation, and demonstration, and press freedom. As a young professor and card-carrying member of the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, I was understandably upset when two strangers, clad in brown suits and Chinese shoes, visited my class in September 1970. I suspected they were FBI or other government agents assigned by the so-called Justice Department to monitor the activities of potential rabble-rousing ACLU members like me, who advocated overthrow of the government. After two visits, they disappeared, but the chilling effect lingered. Nixon's Machiavellian conduct during that time typified executive abuse of power, at times threatening the freedom of speech, press, and political association. I probably didn't make his enemies list, but like others, harbored fear and resentment. Bloomington, Illinois, was also the March 9, 1918 birthplace of George Lincoln Rockwell, pipe-smoking founder of the American Nazi Party. Rockwell was the blatantly racist, homophobic, anti-Semitic who invented the slogan, White Power. For several years after his death in 1967, a tiny band of brown-shirted Nazis came to Bloomington every March 9th to memorialize his birthday. Probably adorning their garb on the outskirts of Bloomington, they marched down the main drag chanting, Sieg Heil, giving the Nazi salute and shouting, Blood and Soil, the same slogan uttered at Charlottesville, Virginia, on August 12, 2017. Our polite but firm protest exposed those white supremacist ideas to the condemnation they deserved, and our moral condemnation, not legal suppression, was the appropriate response to the Nazis' despicable ideas. Our most powerful response to the hated Nazi rhetoric was not suppression, but more speech. Incidentally, Bloomington, Illinois was the birthplace of the American Nazi Party founder and the birthplace of Illinois governor and twice presidential candidate Adlai Stevenson. More evidence that American communities can harbor truly conflicting ideologies. Fast forward to the 2016-2017 Donald J. Trump campaign and presidency. I think the future of the First Amendment may be at issue. According to an earlier 2015 Pew Research Center poll, 40% of millennials think that the government should be able to suppress speech deemed offensive to minority groups, compared with only 12% of those born between 1928 and 1945. Young people today are voicing far less faith in free speech than did their grandparents. Those who oppose the protection of racist speech make several arguments, claiming that the history of mob and state violence targeting African Americans makes racist speech directed at them especially indefensible. Tolerating such speech, they argue, reinforces the harm Americans have done to African Americans, from slavery through Jim Crow to today's de facto segregation, implicit bias, and structural discrimination. And now that white supremacists have a friend in the White House, a different approach seems justified, or so some say. There is some truth in those propositions. America remains profoundly unequal, and our historical treatment of African Americans has been shameful. The scourge of racism persists to this day. Of course, racist speech causes real harm, inspiring violence and intimidating people from freely exercising their own rights. There's no doubt that Donald Trump's appeals to white resentment and his reluctance to condemn white supremacists after Charlottesville on August 12, 2017, have emboldened many racists. But in the public arena, none of those unfortunate truths supports authorizing the state to suppress speech that advocates ideas anti-ethical to egalitarian values. If free speech is critical to democracy and to holding our representatives accountable, we cannot allow our representatives to suppress ideas they think are wrong, false, or disruptive. The state must be neutral with regard to speakers' viewpoints, though it is virtually impossible to articulate a standard for suppression of speech that would not allow government officials dangerously broad discretion and invite discrimination against particular viewpoints. Throughout our history, disadvantaged minority groups have effectively used the First Amendment to speak, associate, and assemble for the purpose of demanding their rights. Where would the movements for racial justice, women's rights, and LGBT equality be without a muscular First Amendment? The response to Charlottesville showed the power of talking back. When Trump declared that there were fine people on both sides, he quickly found himself isolated. Prominent Republicans, military leaders, business executives, and conservative, moderate, and liberal commentators alike condemned the ideology of white supremacy and Trump himself. When white supremacists called a rally in Boston the following week after Charlottesville, they mustered only a handful of supporters, vastly outnumbered by tens of thousands of counter-protesters who peacefully marched to condemn white supremacy, racism, and hatred. Boston proved yet again that the most powerful response to speech that we hate is not suppression, but more speech. The First Amendment protects speech, but not violence. Our history illustrates that unless very narrowly constrained, the power to restrict the advocacy of violence is an invitation to punish political dissent. Historical figures like A. Mitchell Palmer, J. Edgar Hoover, and Joseph McCarthy all used the advocacy of violence as a justification to punish people associated with communists, socialists, or civil rights groups. Yet, in a 1969 ACLU case involving a Ku Klux Klan rally, the Supreme Court ruled that speech advocating violence is protected unless it is likely to incite imminent lawless action. But aside from instances in which speech and violence are inextricably intertwined, speech advocating violence gets full First Amendment protection. Even though the First Amendment poses especially thorny problems of interpretation, free speech enables us to ultimately resolve our differences through public reason. Violence is its antithesis. The First Amendment protects the exchange of views, not the exchange of bullets. We protect the First Amendment not only because it is the lifeblood of democracy and an indispensable element of freedom, but because it is the guarantee of civil society itself. Value and defend the First Amendment, which protects the press, religion, the academy, and political parties. In the era of Donald Trump, the importance of preserving these avenues of advocating justice and preserving democracy should be more evident than ever. And that was why we must protect the First Amendment by Dr. Robert Brake, who lives in Ocean Park, Washington, and contributes to this program quite often. And on a personal note, Dr. Brake's mention of American neo-Nazi George Lincoln Rockwell underscores my first real exposure to the First Amendment and its responsibilities. I was a college journalist 55 years ago in 1963 when Rockwell visited Southern California on a speaking tour. I decided to attend a press conference in Pomona, accompanied by a large footballer friend named Andrew Jackson Haas. Although our purpose was not fully formed, Andy and I thought punching Rockwell in the nose might be a fitting closure of the meeting. I lived in my family home at the time. My father sensed that my interest in Rockwell was not entirely journalistic objectivity. The day I started off to Pomona, he more or less gave me my first tutorial on journalistic ethics in the real world. Hit the nasty Nazi with words, not fists, he said. So Andy and I did not start a fight with Rockwell, but not only for reasons of open-minded fairness. Rockwell placed a presumably loaded pistol on his table for the roomful of reporters and photographers and TV crews to take note of, and he introduced a thick-bodied bodyguard as Irving the Reformed Jew, who was similarly armed. My story lead presented itself when Rockwell's rant was interrupted by a garbage truck outside an open window and clattered a bunch of cans. Garbage inside, upstage by garbage outside was my lead sentence, and my first page one story as well as my first real exposure to the meaning and strength of the First Amendment, which I owe to my father's admonition. Rockwell claimed to be an artist, and I surmised in my story that the root of his Nazism was having been scorned as a second-rate imitation Norman Rockwell. He was later shot by one of his former stormtroopers. I have often wondered if it was Irving, the former Jew. This is Michael McCusker.